the idol makers leave, because Christians and those who are educated in that tradition turn the world upside down because of the role that they play in society. Mm-hmm. And that should be how, that's our goal for our students, is that they would turn the world upside down. Mm-hmm. And it's usually not done like best with like from the top down. It's usually the idol makers just looked around and be like, wow, sales are really low.
Welcome to Classical Etc. You're in the studio with Memoria Press.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Classical Etc. I'm Jessica Gardner, and I am joined today by Martin Cothran, Paul Schaefer, and a returning guest, Mr. Mitchell Holly. Mitchell is the principal at Memoria Academy, our online school at Memoria Press, and he is our resident Greek author and a fan favorite. So we're glad to have Mitchell back.
I just don't understand that.
We're glad to have you again, Mitchell.
The people have spoken, Mark.
I think your most recent episode was the Iliad.
Yeah, that's right? Fun.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, which Tanya came back and had editorial notes afterwards.
We'll do a response to the response later.
Well, on today's episode, we're using our imaginations a little bit on the topic. We're exploring the outworkings of classical education on society. What would our communities be like if classically educated people went into their jobs, had families? How would that affect the community and the world? But before we dive in, what we're reading, so we always like to discuss, Paul? You want to start us off?
I am listening to a book called Life at the Bottom.
Okay.
actually, Dan Scheffler recommended this book to me in one evening where we were discussing things in his library. Mitchell was there. I think it was the three of us. And I have no idea why Dan recommended this book to me. I don't know like what in our conversation sparked this, but the book is itself fascinating. It's a collection of essays from, I think, a medical doctor in England. And it's really interesting about culture.
Is it from a particular point, like time period, or is it
modern day? So okay. I think most of these essays were written in the late 90s.
Okay.
And so it's just his observations, working. And I mean, obviously in England, they still have he would say, it used to have a class society, but now it has moved to a caste society, which is an interesting statement. And he's just, his work has been by and large with the poor section of society. And he looks at like the choices they make and what they consider important and what they don't. And how sort of the mentality contrasts with others. Like one of the things he was talking about is just like responsibility. The way the grammatical phrasing they use denies responsibility for their actions, by and large. And I just, it's insights like that I don't know that I fully agree with all of them, but it is a very interesting book, and it's more phenomenology or anecdotal evidence than actual studies. But he's just saying like, look, when you sit there and you look at this in daily life, this is what I see.
Interesting.
As opposed to academia that's telling us X, Y, and Z, which is fascinating.
Interesting. I actually just bought this book as well. I haven't started reading it, but it hasn't actually come yet, because this was like literally 2 days ago, because someone had mentioned to us recently again.
No, I think you came to me and you were talking about some situation. I was like, this is exactly what was being talked about in this book.
Okay. And so then you bought it, and then I must have bought it because of that conversation.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I haven't read it yet, so I'm excited to jump into it.
Yeah. Mitchell, what else are you reading?
Let's see here. So I just finished a book on participation. It was a long book. I've been reading it slowly for a while. Sort of the metaphysical category of participation, which is important for.
Tell us more.
No one. and then I just started a book on perspectives on natural law. So that might also be important to almost nobody, but, I thought it would be the next book that I would slowly read. When that book comes, I'd like to, Life at the Bottom. I'd like to try that one.
You know, Mitchell, I might read when, that you, one. When you said a whole book about participation, what came to mind was Aristotle's Comments in the Physics, where he's like, really, participation, this is just a poetic word which means nothing.
He didn't say that. I reject the notion. Yeah, it means a lot. It's actually, yeah. Well, I read a whole book on it and I have a lot to say about it. So moving on, because that would bore everyone. But I really enjoyed that book. I'm looking forward to this other book, but it'll definitely be something that sort of sits in the background that I sort of read slowly and sort of meditate with for a bit. I'm sure I'll read other things along the way.
Hmm. Nice. Martin.
Well, I finally finished Death Comes from the Archbishop. Mm-hmm.
By Willa Cather. Took you about as long as it took us to read War and Peace.
Yeah, I know. I do it on my, I don't have my long drive anymore where I can listen to my books, right? Because I've moved to Louisville.
Yeah.
And so now I have to do it on my walks and they're about half an hour, you know, so I don't get as much of that kind of reading done. So finishing that, I went back to a history, back to Theodore Mommsen's second book on the history of Rome. And what strikes me again and again about that, by the way, is how their form of government was developed very naturally from all these relations between these cities in Italy. And they had, you know, they started out with different forms of government and they're all, it struck me that that was something, that was a development that was based on experience and how well things work. And that sort of thing. And, you know, the Romans being a practical people, I just found that very interesting. We want to look at Plato's Republic, you know, and forms of government and this very top-down approach to things. And then, of course, we have here in the United States, we kind of tried to put together in many ways a different form of government, but it was based on the knowledge of what the Romans had discovered and in large part the Romans, I think. I'm reading a novel right now by Neville Shute, Chute, called A Town Like Alice, which is about this woman, actually a group of women, who are trapped in Malaya during, after the Japanese invasion. And they're told to go to this prison camp, like several hundred miles away. And they end up having to walk the whole way. And it turns out there is no prison camp. And so they end up in this Malay village, just helping this little village of Malay people out. And then the guy who, she meets this Australian soldier who's crucified by the Japanese, but he lives. And she doesn't know it until after the war is over. And they had kind of started to develop a relationship, and so they actually meet back in Australia after the war. It's a very interesting story. It's based on a true story.
I was going to ask that because you said a novel, and I'm sitting there going, "Oh, we're getting really fantastical." But
it's based on a true story. Huh. And this is the second book I've read by Neville Shute, and you don't see his books around anymore. You see them you used to see them in used bookstores. He's a very popular novelist at one point in time, Australian. I can't remember the name of the first one I read, but it was also very excellent. Just a great novelist.
I suppose crucifixion is a lost skill.
Apparently
lost it with the Romans.
Yeah, the Japanese didn't quite master it.
Apparently the Japanese did that to Christians.
They did. When the Jesuits were evangelizing there in what, the 1600s, 1700s?
Because that's part of Silence, the movie.
Yes.
Did you?
Right. Yes. That's what I had heard. I haven't read it, but I heard.
We read that in the Memorial Book Club years ago.
And the book was by Endo?
Yes. That's right.
Shoshika Endo?
Something like that. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, that's a fascinating book. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a little hard to read, I think, at points. Mm-hmm. So, yes. Trigger warning.
That's true. That's true. Yeah,
if you want a meditation on the difficulties of remaining faithful and all of that, I mean, it's hard because it doesn't shy from that.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Well, on to today's topic. Mitchell, I'd like to start with you. Before we imagine the outcomes of classical education on society, I think a question before that might be, does classical education only build up the individual? Is it primarily or purely for personal enrichment?
Yeah, that's a really great question, because I think the biggest tendency we have when we talk about education is to talk about it as an individual pursuit. Mm-hmm. And not without mm-hmm. cause, right? That the liberal arts, the liberal skills that sort of set have the potential to set one's mind free, to leave them unaffected by the things that could enslave someone's mind or even their what they could do in life. And so mm-hmm. it actually... A classical education could be a very powerful tool to help an individual person, but Aristotle, from our very earliest writers, right, Plato and Aristotle, they never really envisioned education being a solo thing that was just done for you. It was always done in the context and really with a goal towards the polity as a whole. Mm-hmm. In other words, people should first learn to be in education, to be excellent rulers of themselves so that they can be excellent rulers, doctors, physicians, mothers, fathers in their communities. Mm-hmm. That's why for Aristotle and Plato, it was very, the state has a position on education and what a good education is and what a bad education is, because if you had a bad education, you would have bad politicians that would make bad laws that would destroy the flourishing of the community, right? So education has this necessary outworking in the life of a community by its very nature and since the very beginning. It just is the case that education should shape a polity and in terms of how they live and what they love and what they hate. And what they think the good is and what they think evil is, right?
Well, and I don't think it's necessarily that it should affect, but that it is going to affect.
Oh, sure, yes.
Right? If we're putting all of our children through a particular formation or lack thereof, that's going to absolutely shape what the future of that community is going to be.
Right, and isn't, I always say that one definition of classical education is that it's passing on culture. Well, I mean, didn't the Greeks and the Romans, I mean, didn't their educators view themselves as creating young Greeks and creating young Romans? I mean, it wasn't, that's individualist in some sense, but it's in light of the larger cultural questions. We want to produce good Greeks. Going to produce good Romans. And in the United States, this was very explicit in the late 19th century, early 20th century, we're creating good Americans.
Yeah.
That's just part of what education mm-hmm. is.
Yeah, because the polity and what the polity would be and what its goals would be, what its ideas of the good would be, that was always worked itself out for a group of people. And education is almost a necessary but secondary question. So first you ask the question, what is a good person and therefore what is a good community? And then you ask the question, well, how can we educate and pass that on? How can we take mm-hmm. those ideas about the world, those ideas about what a mother should be, what a father should be, what the role of a politician is, what kind of politician is a good politician? How do we take all of that tradition and pass it on an education? Education was a deeply important matter for everyone to decide. And I think you see that today, regardless of the political spectrum or whatever, everyone agrees that education plays a very important role formatively in a community. And that's why everyone's trying to capture education.
But, and yet I would say there is a basic assumption on the part of the student that this education is about me.
That's right.
And I remember just being taken off guard a little bit when I was teaching in 2019. And I made a comment. We were talking about the transcendentals in class and made a comment about truth, beauty, and goodness and about how, you know, your education ought to train your affections. And I remember this one student and she was like,
what gives you the right to choose what kind of music I ought to like?
Like, well, because I know better than you.
You're a student. I'm the adult. But it was fascinating because even in a community, a small local community that espoused the idea of we are passing on a culture, the individual student had picked up from their broader surroundings that this education was about her, was about, mm-hmm. you know, not her preparation for at the service of the community.
Mm-hmm. I mean, because the attitude of most people, and probably I would guess most parents, is that they send their kids to school to gain skills that they can use in the workplace. It's vocationalism. I mean, that's one of the two great ideologies that control our modern system of education, and that's very self-serving. It has very little to do with being a good citizen. Just giving you skills to do what you're going to make your living doing later on. And I think a lot of education has been reduced to that. Mm-hmm. And so I just think there's a lot of disintegrating influences on our schools, and that's one of the biggest.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's interesting because Mitchell mentioned Plato, and Plato has a whole bunch of funky ideas about, you know, taking the kids away from their family so that the state can educate them in the proper way and all that kind of stuff. But Boethius in the 500s AD writes the Consolation of Philosophy, and in it, he makes very clear, I became a politician. He's talking to Lady Philosophy. He says, I became a politician because you told me to. You said that the reason I had been gifted all of this education was to serve the community, mm-hmm. and the way to do that best was in leading the community through politics, right? Through being a voice in the
creating
conversation.
Creating
good
laws.
Right? And he's all upset because he got thrown in jail for trying to save the lives of all his fellow senators, which, you know, was because he was involved in politics. He's like, if I could have done what I wanted to do, which was sit at home and learn and read and write, I would not be in this situation. But that was clearly an impulse from the classical tradition of you learn in order to serve your community, and you do that by leading.
And can we get specific? So if we're saying this is the classically educated person is a substantively positive and meaningfully positive difference maker in their community, what does that look like?
I think we might go back even one step further and say that the point of a classical education is not just knowledge. It is a knowledge in virtue, right? And it's a practice in virtue. And virtues play themselves out in the debts that we owe to other people. So there's a sense in which by shaping yourself into a type of person, you're actually growing your debts to other people. Like this, the more virtuous, the more courageous I am, the more I need to stand up for others that are maybe not just the people right next to me, but maybe the people just outside of that, right? And to Boethius's point, here's a man so advanced in learning that he realized that he owed a debt to the people around him to try to shape the laws and the governing structure for their benefit because he was at such a level of intellect. So as you grow in the virtues, you look at the relationships that you have and you see the obligation that you have to them to be courageous, to be strong, to be just, to stand up to what is when people say that evil is good and good is evil. Right. And so that means that every role that you enter into in life, whether it's a doctor or a mother or an accountant, because you've been trained in virtue, you recognize the obligation that you owe to people in that role that you play. And so I think that's what the heart of a classical education does in the mind of someone. Well, it does other things for sure, but at least that's one important thing that it does. It creates a certain type of mom. It creates a certain type of father, right? And that's actually much different than someone who'd merely just received job training, right? They merely just learned the skills of how to teach, right? They've learned like all these great pedagogical methods that may or may not yield any fruit. And they've learned all these tricks of the trade, but they may not have actually learned how to be strong for their students, how to work hard for their students, right? And a classical education should do that. It should create that kind of a teacher, right?
Mm. Or simply just what a good human being is,
mm. right?
I mean, most teachers aren't thinking that their job is to help create good human beings. Mm-hmm. If you don't have an idea what that is, then you cannot perform that function.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Imagine if you had a doctor who had actually read Frankenstein and so sort of actually began to wrestle with the question of, I know in my job, I'm learning what physical health is, but what is spiritual health? And how in cognitive health and what is the good for, what does health mean for the whole person?
And what's the place of man with relation to the manipulation we can do for health?
Yes.
Mm. Right. Like, and that's a huge part of it, I think, is the massive temptation in classical education is you become highly trained and the temptation then becomes arrogance and pride. Mm-hmm. But a true classical education that is strongly founded on the virtues, humility is going to be a large part of that. Mm-hmm. And to say, look, you don't get this for yourself, right? This isn't all about you. This is about how you then turn and take these gifts that you've been given and put them at the service of other people. And because otherwise you're just that person who's been given those talents just hoards them, you know, buries them in the ground. Mm. And you're not actually sharing what you've been given.
And it may even be just for your own family or for your own children.
That's right. I think that's a massive point.
Yeah.
It doesn't just have to be, it doesn't have to be in some big way.
Sure. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Cause we all want to do the big things, but it's a lot of people doing the small things. That is what really makes the difference.
Well, and was it C.S. Lewis that said the most important job is actually the mother, you know, who is like functionally training up a new polity in her home. That's a pretty big task. Mm-hmm. She is not only involved in the process of educating, but she is also involved in the process of teaching her children how to live in the world as virtuous children, mm-hmm. you know, as children who stand up to certain things and behaviors. And recognize what's good and what's bad in the world. It's crude that, you know, it sort of goes, is it Russell Kirk who sort of says that those are little platoons of society, right, is the family. Mm-hmm. And it's important if the family starts to suffer, then, I mean, just like a military suffers, if its individual units start acting independently of each other, there's no cohesion. They lack vision. They start attacking each other. Right. Well, the platoons, each family has to be operating on, has to have the same goal in mind. Right. Which actually is something we probably should go talk about at some point, because if education is serving this purpose of creating virtuous students who have excellent control of themselves and then can be a certain way in the world, there is another vision of what that you kind of referenced of what of what education would do to a student, like vocational training, training in certain ideologies that are fundamentally anti-human. Those would all be real threats to someone going into the world and participating in culture and in the polity in a constructive way.
Yeah. And it all starts with those little correctives at the dinner table, you know, Johnny, don't do that to Susie. Now, how would you like if she did that to you? You know, just starting at those little things at home and raising a child who is, who can, number one, see his own behavior as if he were somebody else. Mm. You know, I just noticed that in raising children all those years, that one of the things you're really trying to do is to get them to see the way they're acting, that they're not seeing because they're doing the action. They're not looking at themselves doing the action. Mm-hmm. And reading and literature plays a huge part in that, because they're seeing these characters from this omniscient viewpoint, mm-hmm. right? They're looking down on these characters. They have a sort of godlike view of what's going on. They're seeing what this child, what Tom and Huck are doing. and they're realizing, oh, that looks really stupid. So that later on, when they do something stupid,
or when they do that same thing,
they should do the same thing, and they're gonna all of a sudden remember that story and think of how they felt when they looked at Tom and Huck doing that. So I think it's those just common everyday little correctives, and if you read to your children, all that stuff, I think, is backed up in so many different ways.
Yeah. Paul, I'm thinking of you and your metaphysics class, and, you know, they're upper high schoolers. They're about to launch to university or whatever path is before them. How would you take what we've been talking about and kind of cast a vision for them? People who are almost adults going out there, and they're going to make big decisions about their lives. Mm-hmm. They've been classically educated.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not going to answer your question, but I will say that.
Going to remember that?
that as I've been teaching this year, mm-hmm. I've had segments called Life Lessons with Mr. Schaefer.
Oh.
Where I really try to take what we're talking about, right? If God really mm-hmm. is the first cause of all things, or if happiness is the perfection of all goods, right? Like, or if pleasure is not, in fact, where we find happiness, what does that mean for your life? Mm-hmm. This isn't just like, okay, in a heady space, like, okay, yeah, in a heady space, we can see exactly rationally about why all of that follows. But then now, like, what of it? Mm-hmm. Like, how does this apply to the decisions you're going to make today when you walk out of this room? Because you from a classical perspective, we don't want a bifurcation between the rational ideas they hold in their head and what they actually do, right? Which is where mm-hmm. virtue is embodied, right? We want those two things together. And so, you know, one thing I'm trying to do in the philosophy class is send them out with right ideas, but then also try to marry those ideas to actually the way they live, mm-hmm. you know? And I think some of these kids have a picture of all the things that they've been told not to do that they're going to get to try when they leave for college, and they think that's going to make them happy. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, Boethius goes through, does position, does wealth, does fame, does power, their pleasures. Those are the five things that we often say would make you happy. Anything's make you happy. And he has reasons against it. And then we go into Aquinas, and he brings up the same five, but then he says, well, could it be any bodily good? Could it be a spiritual good? No, happiness resides in God, right? Our mm-hmm. our participation in the life of God is where we find happiness, because that is our final end. And then try to really work through, like, examples, kids, what does this mean? Mm-hmm. And so that's, I think, the role that kind of course plays in kind of tying up that entire education together.
Well, and doesn't this get to the advantage of literature over philosophy? Because we have the philosophical stuff, which we teach, obviously. But what literature does is embody those things.
Didn't you write a logic text, Martin?
Yes.
I don't recall you writing a literature text.
Well, yeah, I've taught literature, though. And I've seen the advantage of having, you know, again, you've got to learn those things, because mm-hmm. most of the writing that you're going to do is not going to be fiction. It's going to be other things, but I think that to be able to see, you know, you could teach to the head, but you also got to teach to the heart. Mm-hmm. You got to make those things be understood in a moral human way, and that's what literature does. You know, reading Dostoevsky, reading Tolstoy, reading some of these books takes those ideas and it puts flesh on them, mm-hmm. and you can see how this works out in real life. And I think that's
the first time I ever taught literature as a young teacher. This was the first, I think this was the first class I ever taught. And so I was young and immature and I was teaching. And I come in and the first question I asked the students is, what is our subject matter? and I had a list of all the books we were going to read, or I had all the books like pile up on the podium. I said, what is our subject matter for this class? And they started raising their hand and listing off the books. And then I pushed the books off the podium and I said, no. And then I drew a stick figure of a man on the board. Man, that is our subject matter. It was, I don't know if it landed at the time, but I think kids were just excited that I threw the books off the podium, which wasn't the point. But to your point, what I tried to do in that class and what I've tried to do in every literature class that I have taught, which I never get to teach literature anymore, but is to draw their attention back to this central question about what a human is, and what are threats to being fully human. And this is where, you know, I think the kids in your class, Paul, are hopefully they'll be equipped by a class like that to be able to go out into the world and face all of these potential manifestations of what a human is and what a human should be, and be able to answer, is that a final cause? No, that's actually a threat to like me achieving the ends by which, for which I was created. Which, you know, whenever they get out into society, and here's where, you know, to kind of get to the heart of the episode, right, is they've been educated in this certain classical tradition about what a human is. And then they're going to get out into society and they're going to be confronted with pluralism, with all these other ideas about what it means to be a human. Mm-hmm. And so they're going to be, you know, whether they're a doctor or an accountant or going to go do an MBA or be a lawyer or just be a mom or just be a dad or whatever, they're going to be confronted with all these narratives about what a human is. Mm-hmm. And so society is a confusing place, or it can be. And so if they don't have this foundational sort of narrative about what a human is, when they do get out into society, when confronted with that sort of the pluralism out there of all these other ways, they could be deeply confused. They could be, and they could spend their whole life toiling towards certain ideas of money, of wealth, of power, whatever. Or something worse than those five, which they exist today.
Yeah. Cause they
all get encapsulated somehow.
It's hard to get students to care sometimes about the more abstract things we try to teach them, but they do care about people. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I brought in literature in this regard, is that then you're providing an embodied example of what you're talking about, and it's a person in a story, and that person is relating to other persons in that story, and that's much easier to care about.
Mm. Oh, sure.
Than more abstract.
And I think when you're talking about teaching a child, right, that in some ways it is more important for them to see it embodied than for them to understand the abstract, rational, step-by-step, you know, principles or whatever that story is an outworking of. But once they're an adult, it's important for them to have those step-by-step principles, because those other narratives, because they're going to be watching other stories, reading other stories, hearing about other stories, where the fundamental assumptions or principles in that story are actually contrary to what is true and what they can defend as true rationally. And they need to be able to examine it in the light of those principles.
Well, and isn't this the beauty of somebody like Plato? Because you read The Republic or something, and he's talking about abstract philosophical ideas, but he's explaining them using myths, the allegory of the cave, the ring of Gyges, all these things that he knows, Plato knew the value of giving somebody a picture of the intellectual things he's talking about.
I'd be curious to know if I could ask a question. Am I allowed to ask a question? Okay.
Okay, that's dangerous, just so you know.
We reserve veto rights.
Yeah, you reserve veto rights. That's fine.
We might answer it.
Yeah, understood. The importance of, the cold reality is, like, when those great defenses of classical education that were written in the early 1900s or the late 1800s, those things all presumed that the polity, that the community, that society had a clear idea and agreed about what the good was. Mm. And our students today hopefully we're passing on that tradition. But as soon as they graduate, they're going to step into a society that does not agree with them about what the good is. And so our students are going to be trying to be like be like a virtuous accountant, but they're going to be surrounded who has a clear idea of his, like what a human is and what his role is to himself and to his family. But then he's going to be surrounded by accountants that have other narratives by which they live their life. How do our students challenge, or how are they challenged, and how do they push back in that sort of environment? Like, there are all these competing ideas out there that don't agree with classical education and the virtues that we're trying to instill with our students. How do they bump up against that? Are they successful? Are they not successful? What would make them successful? Mm-hmm. You've been doing this the longest. Did you understand? Did the question make sense?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I'm trying not to talk politically here, but you know, I do think there is a tendency in our culture to think that our role in life is to protest some injustice. And obviously there are times when that's necessary. But I think one of the advantages of classical education is that it's constructive. It's not destructive. You are offered these models of how you should be rather than rebelling against the thing that shouldn't be. I mean, that's a natural byproduct of that, but it's not the main thing. The main thing is I said this before, but the chief pedagogical thing in classical education is imitation. And what we do is we teach children how to imitate good models. That is the chief pedagogical principle in classical education. And it's not trying to tear down something that you don't like. It's trying to construct something or find some model and say, I want to be like that, mm-hmm. or our culture should be like that, or, you know, something like that.
Mitchell, you were talking about sort of like when the student goes out into the world and bumps up against, you know, other people that are living by a different narrative. And the one thing that came to my mind was Joshua's, "As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord," mm-hmm. right? Like, there's fundamentally, until there is one thing is, thankfully, our laws will throw somebody in jail who goes too far, right? For the most part, our laws are still a recognition of the traditional
that evil exists and should be punished. Yeah.
But until there's a concentrated you know what I'm talking about, the
critical mass.
Thank you, Jessica. A critical mass of people that are living their lives, right, and their own little sphere of influence. And once there's enough of us that have been trained in the traditional virtues, mm-hmm. then the people that will seem to be on the outs are the people that are living by some other narrative.
Yeah.
That is not in accord with reality.
Yeah. I'm reminded here of Boethius because I read it because I was subbing for your class. Yes. And this is the first time I've ever read it. It was this year. And to my shame, I hadn't read it up until this point. But he talks about each of those five areas where humans are tempted to find happiness, and he sort of debunks them all. But then he comes back to them in the next book and he says that those are all partial answers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they are bad particularly because they're partial. But when we recognize what the good is and where the good is to be found, then those partial answers can be integrated into the whole. And our students, when they step out into society, are going to be inundated with partial answers mm-hmm. to what it means to be a human, to what the good is, what women should pursue, what men should pursue, what a good father is, what a good politician is, what a bad politician is. Those are all partial answers. And so in our own individual, this goes back to Alistair McIntyre's, one of his central theses is that we probably shouldn't try to like grab the reins of power and change things from the top down because you will actually not change any of the hearts and the minds of people in the society. It's probably more effective to get together to build local small communities, right? Of like barbers and politicians and you know, all these other traits sort of getting together and just living virtuously with one another. And build, that really starts at a family unit, right? This is to your point, you know, sort of look mm-hmm. locally into yourself and try to establish and cultivate that in yourself and in your family and in the people immediately around you. And that could be a huge avenue for change, in society more broadly, right? Because we don't have a central definition anymore in our culture about what a society should be anymore and what the goals of society should be. And probably the best way to prepare your students for that sort of pluralism out there is to remind them, is to be humble and remind them to be humble, like have simple aspirations. Just be a good dad. Just be a good mom. Just be a good accountant. And by good, footnote everything you've learned by good, you
take,
know.
Take the countryside and the cities will fall, sure. which comes from Mao Zedong's The Little Red Book. But it's actually true. But it is true, yeah. Which is why he's successful.
The transcendental of truth is actually a real thing. It's, you can find truth anywhere.
Right. And the Christian aspect of this, particularly as it's applied to classical education, where we're trying to find the good things to imitate, and we have God in human flesh, who we can imitate is a person. All the theology and everything is great, but you have this embodied in a person, and you imitate Christ, which was a call of the church. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, I always say classical education, and I sometimes catch myself in that. I really should be saying classical Christian education, because those principles that we talk about are Christianity makes that even more pronounced.
Mm-hmm. Because it gives you a person. It's embodied in the life of a person.
Yeah,
and and that's the call to our student. And I think sometimes when we talk about or think about education and society, our first impulse is to talk about, how do we take over the society? Mm-hmm. Well, if we just had the right person in power, mm-hmm. or we just had enough senators.
We want to do it top down.
Yes, we want to do it top down, you know, which we've tried before, and it doesn't always work. And, you know, probably the more fundamental, but ultimately longer, like over centuries, mm-hmm. Principle of having kids and teaching them to live with wisdom and virtue, like their model, Jesus. Mm-hmm. Like it goes back to, you know, what if Jesus was a lion and he lived in a place called Narnia, what would he do? Mm-hmm. I think the challenge of classical education is you tell your students, what if Jesus was Timmy? And he had all the obligations that Timmy has. What would he do? How would he be wise with his personal finances? Plug, we're teaching our personal finance class this summer.
Mm-hmm. Co-teaching.
Yeah. That'll be fun. Two cats running in the opposite direction. But challenge your students. You know, what would God be, what would he say in the mode of Timmy, given the fact that Timmy wants to be a doctor one day? What sort of doctor would Jesus be? Right. Mm-hmm. In the world today, try to embody that, live their out non-identical repetition of Jesus in that role, mm-hmm. Which we teach our students in something like classical composition, right? Here's the model. Mm-hmm. You need to repeat that model, mm-hmm. with infinite variety. Mm-hmm. Right. Jesus is the model. Let's imitate him with infinite variety in all the roles that you play.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, a key thing for us to remember, which we've gone back to, I think time and time again in this conversation is, without explicitly saying it, but Jesus started by calling fishermen and tax collectors and zealots. You know, these are not, I mean, he was not calling the governors and the, you know, the
sick and the prostitutes. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. He was calling them. Right. Yeah. And so it is in doing the small things well that, we in fact affect a change, right? Where our society, the what we have been given will disseminate out by not worrying about the big things, but saying, what can I do better in my family? What can I do better in my school, in my church, in my, you know, where I work,
there's that
in my neighborhood.
Hilarious scene in Acts where Paul goes in and preaches the gospel for a while, and then all the idol makers get together and they're like, shoot.
We're running their business.
We're going out of business. We got to throw these Christians out. And the Christians are like, well, listen, we're not turning the world upside down. And literally the accusation against the Christians from these idol makers are, no, you are turning the world upside down. We will not have jobs. It's like when the Christians come in to a community, the sex trade leaves, the idol makers leave, because Christians and those who are educated in that tradition turn the world upside down because of the role that they play in society. Mm-hmm. And that should be how, that's our goal for our students, is that they would turn the world upside down. Mm-hmm. And it's usually not done like best with like from the top down. It's usually the idol makers just looked around and be like, wow, sales are really low.
Well, and you know, the Memorial Press started out of the involvement of Cheryl Lowe and I in state politics because of a very unpopular education reform bill that was passed here. And we were in the opposition. But when it was all said and done, we didn't continue on in the politics. We got out of that. And instead of criticizing the wrong things, we tried to start, you know, instead of criticizing the way they were trying to run schools in the state, we just started our own school. And now Highlands is a model school for classical educators across the country. And I don't think people realize the effect that classical education has already had. Mm. It is the only thing I see growing in the education world. Mm. And it's dramatically growing. Mm. I don't know what the statistics are, but I'd be willing to bet that the majority of new private schools that are being started are classical.
Oh, for sure.
You know, I think any question about that. That this is the big growth thing in education. And we're not doing it necessarily by changing the public schools or by, mm-hmm. You know, in some cases, changing private schools. This is a ground up thing that's, it's already happening the way we're talking about, the way it should happen. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for the wonderful discussion. Yeah. And thank you for joining us today. We will be back next week. If you want to learn about any of our materials, we mentioned Boethius and Paul's materials, you can find that and more at memoriapress.com.
And you can find the personal financial literacy class.
It's full, I think.
At memoriaacademy.com.
memoriaacademy.com. And we'll see you next time. Thank you for joining us today on Classical Etc. by Memoria Press. If you like what you heard, you can follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. To learn more about Memoria Press, please go to memoriapress.com. This has been Classical Etc. We're so glad you joined us, and we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to the Memoria Press Podcast Network, providing a classical Christian perspective on the world of education. To learn more about Memoria Press, visit us at memoriapress.com. To connect with us, find us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.